The panel is Risch versus Simeo. Consolidated cases 58504, 59208, and 59423. Mr. Polsenberg, you ready to proceed?
Yes, thank you, Your Honor. Good afternoon, Your Honor. May it please the Court, Dan Polsenberg for the appellant defendant, Jenny Risch. In this single case, we see three different and troubling strategies that seem to be going on a lot in trials in Las Vegas. They are, first of all, motions to try to keep facts out of the case, to keep the jury from hearing all of the facts and consequently deciding on the factual issues, here, as in many other cases, dealing with causation. Secondly, it's a tendency for some lawyers to present an issue in a motion in limine and then broaden it and expand it during trial. And third, and most troubling, and what is probably the issue in the case, is using alleged violations of the expansion of that order to get sanctions, including striking the answer and case concluding and ultimate sanctions. Let me try to cover four points today simultaneously. First of all, the district court's order was incorrect. Secondly, there was no violation of the order, and it's incorrect even as it was first made, let alone as it was expanded. And there was no violation of the order as it was first made. Third, if there is a violation of the expanded order, it wasn't intentional. And finally, if there was a violation, intentional or not, it doesn't justify the sanction here. Plaintiffs moved in limine to basically keep out the facts of the accident. This was a low-impact accident, and they made a motion titled Motion in limine to keep out the fact that it's a low-impact accident. Now, that's not what their motion was about, although that was the title. The motion was about, and the order coming from it, kept out three things. It kept Dr. Fish, our defense expert, and other medical doctors from talking about the low-impact accident. It kept out photographs of the damage, or I would submit the lack of damage, to the motor vehicle. And it kept out the repair costs. And the basis for that argument was, or the basis for that motion, was under Hallmark. And what plaintiffs were saying is defendants didn't have a biomechanical expert, and so medical doctors can't talk about whether the force was enough to have caused the alleged injuries here. Now, that turns, in my mind, Hallmark on its head. Hallmark was a case that said that a biomechanical expert couldn't talk about medical causation. It wasn't a case that said that doctors can't say, well, if it was a low-impact injury, there couldn't have been medical causation. But that's what plaintiffs argued, and that's what Judge Walsh ruled. But Judge Walsh ruled in the context of Dr. Fish wasn't allowed to say it, the photographs don't come in, and the repair costs don't come in. Repair costs and photographs weren't an issue. It came up in three of plaintiff's experts, where they had come in and testified as to causation. And the first time with Dr. Rossler, the defendant said, well, was anybody else transported? Now, the plaintiff was not transported by ambulance from the scene of the accident. And defense counsel says, was anybody else transported? Objection, relevance. Only relevance. It was sustained. With Dr. McNulty, basically the same question. And when plaintiffs objected that time, defendants said, well, this is clearly relevant. And I submit, even under Hallmark, this is clearly relevant. The jury is allowed to know the facts of the case, to know whether it was high impact or low impact. Those are the things that juries take into account in deciding cases.
Is there any Nevada cases on the issue of the pictures and the repair calls?
There are some cases in criminal cases about photographs, but I think that goes to a different issue. I'm not really raising the photographs and the repair costs because my issue in this case really goes to striking the answer.
You are arguing that the threshold decision by Judge Walsh was incorrect. I want to read this question to you and ask you and Mr. Wall to comment on it.
Please.
In a personal injury case arising from a motor vehicle accident, may a defendant place in evidence photographs, and I'll add, or other evidence, showing minimal property damage and argue in closing argument to the jury that the photographs and other evidence relating to the accident support an inference that the plaintiff was not injured, absent expert testimony establishing a correlation between property damage and personal injury?
And I don't think that, and as I say, my issue isn't the photographs. I'm not going to the photographs. I point out the photo, because I don't think, and repair costs I've never argued have to go to the jury, because the jury would not only have to know the forces involved that would affect in property damage, they would also have to know how much it costs to repair a vehicle. So I don't have a problem with excluding the repair costs. I bumped a car in an IHOP parking lot once and it cost me $500, and it was just a tiny bump. I'm not asking for that. What I'm saying is that under the judge's ruling having to do with the facts of the accident, it only went to what Dr. Fish could say. I think that is incorrect, but nonetheless the sanction was based on four incidences other than the incident involving Dr. Fish. In the second one, having to do with Dr. McNulty, defense counsel argued, well, this is relevant. Did I violate some order? And plaintiffs even argued it doesn't need to be an order. They were arguing relevance at the time, not violation of an order. And the third instance, too, with Dr. Grover. That came up, and there I think clearly the defense should have been able to get into that, because Dr. Grover was talking about hyperflexion injuries and the type of injury that was involved. You'd be able to, under a Williams type of analysis, cross-examine the expert who is testifying as to causation. Well, do you know the facts of the accident where you're saying this accident caused this? But the judge wouldn't let us get into that. The fourth question had to do with asking the plaintiff himself. He had testified he was not transported. We then asked him, was anybody in Jetty Rich's, the defendant's car, transported? There was never an order saying that you couldn't ask percipient witnesses about that. The order only said Dr. Fish and other medical doctors, and I think that goes to defense doctors. Plaintiffs had filed one of those secret briefs that is now not proper, but was proper at the time, about being able to exclude even percipient witnesses testifying about the facts of the evidence. We didn't know that at the time. So our question was, I think, proper, didn't violate the order, and as such, it shouldn't have been the basis of a sanction, and certainly not so extreme a sanction.
On page 2 at lines 7 and 8 of the court's order, she says, it is hereby ordered that plaintiff's request to preclude defendant from raising a minor or low-impact defense is granted.
No, it says the motion is granted.
Mm-hmm.
Right, but that was the name of the motion, Your Honor. That's what I'm saying. It's one of the problems is you make a motion with a broad title, and then it asks for three specific things. Dr. Fish and other medical doctors can't testify to this. The photographs don't come in, and the repair costs don't come in. And then you take the specific motion that has a broad name and use that to make it broader. So, and we had repeatedly asked what it was we could say and couldn't say. And on the first two questions, there was never, ever an indication that we couldn't get into, she only talked about, and by she, I mean Judge Walsh, and I apologize for that. Judge Walsh only talked about relevance, didn't talk about the order. And then when it got it, even after the third question, when we get to the fourth question, there had never been an indication except for that one broad line, which is simply playing off the title of the motion.
Well, how is the transport of the defendant or their passengers relevant even assuming that it isn't covered by this order?
It is relevant. It's certainly not conclusive.
Injuries sustained by the defense in a car accident or their transport?
Judge, remember, we didn't want to just get into that. We wanted to get into that it was low speed. There was a huge discussion even before the trial. Can we get into that it was a low speed accident? Can we get into that it was just a tap? And the judge was not forthcoming.
And you think that there's an ambiguity about her saying, whether it's right or wrong is a separate question, but you believe there's an ambiguity in her saying you can't. She says on the record,
characterization,
you can't talk about tap, you can't talk about those.
Those are things that I asked to be able to say in opening statement. Are characterizations.
But she keeps saying you cannot do so. Whether she's right or wrong about that.
Judge, but she wouldn't let us get in. She never said, even though plaintiffs kept arguing, you cannot get, the order says you cannot get into the facts of the accident. Judge Walsh never said that that's what the order said. And you know, if we're going to bring this issue up on appeal, we have to get clarification on what the order is. The judge never gave us that. Yes, I absolutely, if we lay out page after page after page where we try to get clarification, we're working under the assumption we can't characterize it, we can't argue it, but we can bring in the facts.
This is why I wanted to go back to the threshold question in the first issue you started with,
yes.
And that is whether or not in a case in which there's a dispute about the extent of the impact, is evidence admissible where there's no expert that draws a correlation between property damage and personal injury?
And I'm not arguing property damage. What I'm arguing is the facts of the accident itself, that it was low speed,
Let me rephrase the question.
Certainly.
Is a judge's order proper that precludes admission of evidence concerning the circumstances surrounding a low-impact accident where there is no expert to draw a correlation between the personal injury and the extent of the impact?
Where there's no biomechanical expert, that ruling would be improper because Dr. Fish would have said, no, a low-impact accident could not have caused this injury.
Okay.
I'd like to save my 3 minutes for rebuttal.
All right.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Wall?
Thank you very much. Good afternoon. May it please the Court. David Wall on behalf of William and Cheryl Simeo.
Could you begin by addressing whether the Court's order was correct or incorrect? There seems to have been some reliance on a case out of Delaware and Maryland. Our research indicates that those cases have been substantially rejected. I think this is an issue of first impression in this jurisdiction. I've tried to phrase this question several times. I'll try again. The question is, in the absence of expert testimony in a low-impact vehicle collision, is evidence about the accident admissible?
Evidence about the accident can be admissible, and I think it must be necessary to distinguish this case, perhaps, from a general rule. And I'm not trying to duck the question in any way. I hope you don't think that. But
well, I guess in the absence of an expert witness, should it be? We assume, I think, for years of practice, that it is. And in reading cases from several jurisdictions, they apparently permit it.
Right.
But the question is, when the person comes in and testifies, well, I got bumped, and there was very little damage. But the claim is that the plaintiff sustained much more serious injuries. How is the jury to draw a correlation between the nature of the accident and the degree of personal injury sustained without the assistance of an expert?
They cannot. And really, if you look at the underlying basis of Hallmark, which is a biomechanical opinion from, I think it was a flight surgeon, that this court found to be unqualified to give that opinion, it was because the underlying basis of that, and every single physician or orthopod will tell you that there is no correlation between the depth of the impact or the property damage and the injuries that may be sustained. Dr. Fish, and I believe Dr. Wong, who was the orthopedic surgeon who was defendant's expert, along with the plaintiffs, and virtually everyone will agree that there is no correlation, no scientific correlation as a matter of medicine or as a matter of science between the amount of impact and the injury. Certainly, there can be, but there isn't as a general scientific rule. That is, people who walk away from an accident that involves a rollover and the car is totaled and walk away without injury, those who are injured severely in what may be called a minor impact, that was part of the court's rationale behind Hallmark in the first place. That someone who is not qualified ought not to be testifying to something that doesn't pass scientific muster, much less the methodology required under Hallmark.
Well, a biomechanical expert may not be able to under Hallmark, but why can't a doctor? Why can't a doctor come in and say, well, I don't see how this plaintiff could have sustained these injuries based on my understanding of the nature of the collision?
Well, it depends on the nature of that opinion and what that opinion is based on. In this case, Dr. Fish relied only on photographs. And that takes us back to the whole line of cases on accident reconstruction and establishing speed, like Levine and Choate and Gordon, I think, versus Hurtado, that said, look, just looking at the photographs, you can't make any determination about the nature of the impact, the loads, the coefficients of friction, and how much force might be placed on the body.
The basis of Dr. Fish's view in this case doesn't seem to be the reason that the judge excluded the evidence. It appears instead that she excluded the evidence because she didn't feel that any evidence about the degree of the impact was admissible. Is that true?
Essentially, yes. I mean, we did, the respondents below did a motion to preclude this particular affirmative defense, or this particular defense, like you might preclude an affirmative defense of contributory negligence where there's no evidence to support it. And the only evidence there was to support it in the opposition was the testimony of Dr. Fish and the photos and the estimates. And the appellants don't complain that the photos and estimates, and understand that liability was conceded in this case.
But the judge acknowledged that causation was still an open question.
Correct. And understand that
I'm
that
trying to figure out how you establish causation if you can't talk about the nature of the accident.
Well, it wasn't so much that you couldn't discuss the nature of the accident. It is primarily the fact that there was no biomechanical expert on behalf of the defense to raise this defense that this impact was too minor, either as a matter of science, a matter of fact, or a matter of law, to have caused this injury was precluded based on the fact that the defense had insufficient evidence in order to propound that theory. And what made the violations at trial all the more prejudicial to the plaintiff is because once that order that Your Honor just read from was entered, the issue of whether the impact was sufficient enough, given the nature of the collision, wasn't addressed by the respondents in jury selection. That issue wasn't brought up during opening. It wasn't brought up on direct of any of the witnesses. And the respondents, William and Cheryl Simeo's own biomechanical expert, was released as a result of the court's order that said that this would not be a viable defense. And that placed us in the position of not bringing that issue to the jury.
Which takes us full circle, though, to the threshold question. Was the judge's order appropriate as a matter of law? And this is why I am posing this question again about even in the absence of an expert, is not other evidence concerning the nature of the impact still admissible? There seems to be a lot of cases that permit that evidence, even if it isn't photographs and repair bills.
Right. And I would answer that question respectfully in two ways. One is that given the state of the evidence that the defense had, all they had on this issue was Dr. Fish, who looked at the photographs. So even in a particular case where there was sufficient underlying basis for an expert's conclusion, perhaps that's a hallmark call for the judge prior to trial on a motion to exclude the expert. Here, just having looked at the photographs and saying, making that conclusion, the district court found to be insufficient, and there wasn't any other evidence that the defendant proffered on the issue of minor impact.
Mr. Wall, is it your position that a doctor shouldn't have testified as to either side as to injuries?
No, not at all.
Because if we're taking up biomedical, we have someone, we're putting them out there, we're saying they're injured. Do we only have the testimony of the individual saying, I'm hurt? Or do we at least let doctors give us medical findings?
We let doctors give medical findings.
And why was this doctor then precluded from being limited to given only medical findings?
All he was precluded from doing was saying that I don't believe there were sufficient biomechanical forces in the nature of this accident to have caused this injury. That is what he was woefully short on facts to be able to support. Understand that there was an agreement.
I asked the question because later on there was testimony that one of your doctors was asked about injury, and that was even stricken. So it's almost like the record was devoid of any testimony from any doctor, exclusion of medical bills,
correct,
that the injury even occurred.
And I think what the state of the evidence was from a medical perspective, even from the defense, was that this was a degenerative condition. I don't believe the evidence was, you're not injured. And the evidence was not, and I believe the defense conceded that at least the treatment he got shortly after the accident was related to the accident. There was about a four-month gap that the defense
argued.
And if
we're talking about degenerative, then we kind of take biomedical and throw them out the door, and we only are looking at medical testimony from doctors, treating physicians or IME physicians or experts.
Correct. And much of the medical testimony was, look, this was a degenerative condition, or it may have happened anyway, even without the accident. The testimony was basically about the fact that there were no prior neck complaints, whether his prior migraines were medically related to the condition of his cervical spine. Those are the kinds of issues that the doctors were allowed to opine on on both sides. It's that particular biomechanical opinion. I don't think the force in this impact, from looking at the photos of a Chevy Suburban hitting a work van, was sufficient enough.
Well, we said they're not objecting to the striking of the photos at this juncture.
Right. Right. The second area of this, and
let me take you to another area because I'm curious and your time's rolling down.
Right.
We had this order. We later had, based upon what occurred, the striking of an answer.
Right.
We have a situation, a due process issue, that the judge made a determination as to what the proper damages were because a jury was dismissed. And literature kind of goes back and forth about due process is proper if you keep the jury and have testimony given to them so they can opine about what the proper nature of damages are, opposed to...
Yeah, I think the trial court followed something similar to, I believe it's Hamlet versus Reynolds, the Reynolds part I'm not sure of, I admit, where once the answer is stricken and a default is entered, that at that point the due process considerations of having the jury determine damages are gone, and the trial court can go ahead and make that determination in the absence, essentially, of an answer like a default prove-up. I think it was either Bahena versus Goodyear where there was a striking of the answer as to liability only, and the jury went forward and determined damages in that case, and even the issue of punitive damages. But I take issue with this dichotomy of remedies that the defense has offered, that somehow striking the answer is only appropriate pre-trial, and that willful violations or misconduct during trial, the only possible sanction is either monetary or a mistrial, or in addition to things like sustaining of the objection and directing the jury to disregard. Especially in the situation, and the transcript in this case is replete with references to the fact that it was the belief of the plaintiffs below, the respondents before this court, that the appellants, the defendant below, wanted a mistrial. And it cannot be that the non-offending party, when there has been misconduct during trial, is only allowed to request that we re-rack a new jury and start over again. That essentially rewards the offending party for the conduct, especially when the offending party is in a much greater financial position than the non-offending party who has been subjected to the misconduct. And of course, 37B talks about striking the answer as a remedy for discovery violations, the same public policy considerations that would go into allowing the striking of an answer for, as in Bahena, failing to properly authenticate interrogatory answers or discovery issues like that, that when there's willful violations at the time of trial, somehow there should be a lesser remedy when, in fact, the public policy concerns are exactly the same.
Mr. Wall, in page 8 of the judge's order imposing sanctions striking the answer, the judge recounts that in the motion that the plaintiffs filed, they sought an order that precluded the defendant from arguing, suggesting, or insinuating at trial that the crash was a minor impact or low impact collision and not significant enough to cause plaintiff's injuries. That's quoted.
Right.
And she then says, I granted that motion in its entirety.
Right.
Then this sentence, defendants provided no evidence or information to correlate the amount of damage to a vehicle in a collision to the severity of the injury suffered by a passenger. Isn't that exactly what Dr. Fish wanted to say or was expected to testify to? Or is your understanding of his testimony different?
Well, twofold. Yes and no, I guess, is the easy answer. And if I may be allowed to.
Yes, please.
He was a pain management doctor. He was not an orthopedic surgeon. He was not, they had a separate orthopedic surgeon doctor. His opinions were myriad, and one of them was, I looked at the photos of the accident, and that was one of the bases of my opinion. I don't believe that he ever testified how or what it was about the photographs or what damage or the depth of damage or the lack of certain damage that related in any way to a scientific or medical conclusion that this impact or any literature to support it or any peer-reviewed studies or any of the things that this court talked about in Hallmark to reach the conclusion that there was any competent evidence to support his opinion that the photographs alone allowed him to reach a biomechanical conclusion.
And then second question is, do you have any cases that indicate or conclude that a defendant is precluded from arguing or insinuating at trial that the crash was a minor impact or low impact collision and not significant enough to cause plaintiff's injuries?
In the absence of an order?
Is that legal conclusion correct? What authority supports that legal conclusion? Why can't a defendant come in and testify it was a tap?
I would say the same policy concerns that, and even if she says it was a tap, to take the next step and say, I wasn't injured. And I understand, we never got to the point of whether she could testify and, you know, her up there and being precluded from testifying that it was a tap. Mm-hmm. And that wasn't the violations. The violations were, since you weren't injured, defendant, the plaintiff could not be injured. And in fact, that was the justification for the defense counsel at trial asking the same question over and over at one of the conferences.
Well,
at
Mr.
Wall,
I'm sorry for interrupting, yeah. But the judge's characterization of her order in the order striking the answer is that I, trial judge, precluded the defendant from arguing, suggesting, or insinuating at trial that the crash was a minor impact or low impact collision and not significant enough to cause plaintiff's injuries.
Right.
And the court, as I understand the issue on appeal, the threshold issue on appeal, is whether that ruling is correct.
Well, I would say yes, that ruling is correct given the evidence presented and the arguments made both in the briefs and at the time of the hearing. Secondarily, I would say that there's a remedy if you believe the court's order on a motion in limine is incorrect, and it is not to violate it, and it is not to repeatedly violate it with the exact same question four times. And you can't justify violating an order by arguing about the wisdom of the order.
Until you get on appeal.
Until you get on appeal,
and
exactly.
That changes. That I think the point is, the judge rules, if it's error, you got to wait till there's an appeal to resolve that error. You shouldn't be arguing with the judge
in
the course of the proceedings, and I think that's some of that. But I don't want to conflate the question. There still is an issue before us on appeal. Was the judge's order, as a threshold question, correct or incorrect?
The judge's order, I would submit, was correct based on the evidence that the defendant in this case offered to present in support of a scientific conclusion that the impact was too minor to have caused this injury.
Okay. Any other questions for Mr. Wall?
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Wall. Mr. Paulsenberg?
Thank you, Your Honor. We're talking about my threshold issue, and I raised it first because it is threshold. It's not primary. I think the ultimate issue is the sanction for the trial conduct. But let's talk about the threshold issue first. This court in Fox versus Cusick, which we talked about in the district court and extensively here, did determine that the facts of an accident and whether it's foreseeable or low impact, even without an expert, are proper for the jury to consider. Yeah, we had Dr. Wong and we had Dr. Fish, and yes, Dr. Fish even got to the point at trial, and we were sanctioned for it, where he said that his opinion was based on all the facts and circumstances of the accident. He was ready. I don't think we need a biomechanical expert. We can present it through Dr. Fish. We can do it if we can't do it based on photographs. We can do it on hypotheticals. Now, doctor, if such and such, based on the testimony, I'm going to give you a hypothetical based on the testimony of all the witnesses, if that's there, were the forces enough to do it, we can do it. And I brought up Williams versus District Court earlier.
Justice Hardesty, and I talked about how to do it through cross-examination of Dr. Grover. And this goes to Justice Douglas's point, where we could have come in. He said it was all hyperextension and hyperflexion, and there needed to be a certain force to do that. And we could have come in and cross-examined him. Should have been able to do it. We tried to do it, and the judge said that we couldn't do it. And to Justice Douglas's other point, under plaintiff's theory, any plaintiff can come in and tell his treating physician that the accident led to his injury, and that's admissible, and we can't bring in anything else without a biomechanical expert. Now, Hallmark is based on the fact that we don't trust biomechanical experts. It's not a real science. And to turn it on its head and then say that doctors can't testify to medical causation because they're not biomechanical is just wrong. And I think the Seventh Circuit talked about this in Cooper, which is a case we cite. While plaintiff's theory may rest on the veracity of plaintiff's medical history, that's got to be subject to a meaningful examination, and that examination includes the circumstances of the accident. Let me get to what I think the real issue in this case is, and that's the severity of the sanction. This didn't justify striking an answer, as I said before, even if it were a violation, because it was only a question that had to do with your point, Your Honor, were other people transported? Is that something we have to strike an answer for and deny due process and not allow a case to be tried? Your Honor, read from an 8-page order. The order from the judge under which we operated during trial was only 2 pages. And that was an unclear order. We kept asking for determinations. You know, I am probably...
What I read from was her quote from the motion. In her order imposing the sanctions.
Right, I know that.
And compared that, and she said she granted the motion in its entirety. So,
And the order in its entirety talks about, first it says it grants the motion, and it says having to do with minor or low-impact defense, and then it goes into Dr. Fish, and then it goes into property damage photos, and it goes into sub rosa videos. And so this isn't the, that, and one of the problems I have, you know, this court last Thursday decided FCH1 LLC versus Rodriguez. And 2 points out of that case. One is, Justice Pickering said, relying on Morsicato and Williams, you don't need these magic words. It's ridiculous to say that a defendant can't come in and defend itself in a low-impact case when you've got medical experts who are going to testify, when you've got percipient witnesses who are going to testify. It's crazy to say that there's got to be some magical word and you have to have a biomechanical expert to do that. The other point that case makes, of course, is it adopted our argument. I won't go into it because I didn't go into it earlier about reassigning this case from Judge Walsh on remand. But this court talked about here in this argument today about what you normally do if a judge rules and it's incorrect, you have to live with it and appeal it. But trust me, I know that. I face that situation almost every trial I'm in. But in this case, we couldn't get a clarification of what was in and what was out. That's what we did want to do. We did want to establish what the ruling was, what the law of the case was. And when we kept trying to do it and we didn't get clarification, we had to ask the question. And it just did not justify striking the answer. Okay. Thank you, Your Honor.
All right. This matter will stand submitted. Thank you for your arguments, counsel, and your briefs in the case. We'll be in recess.